Hello, fellow Kentuckians and other friends, and welcome to a new edition of My Own Kentucky Podcast. My name is Robert Connie, and joining me, as always, is Jasmine Smith. Jasmine, how are you today?
Doing well, Robert. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Today, we spend most of the show speaking with Bruce Maples, the publisher of Forward Kentucky, about all of the bills that passed or were about to pass at the end of the session. It's about a 40-minute conversation, and it is great. Bruce really crushed it in the coverage of the end of the session. He knew a ton about all the bills that went through, and we really enjoyed and are fortunate to be able to talk with him about all that stuff because he's a true expert. So it was a good conversation.
Mm-hmm.
So definitely stick around from that. We have two very short stories for you before we get to that conversation. Well, really just one short story. Jasmine's going to talk to us about Wayne Lewis and some sick days, and then we have a few quick hits to just kind of catch up on the week that was this week. So without any further ado, Jasmine, tell us about Wayne Lewis.
All right. People may already know about this story because it's a little bit old at this point. This happened last Thursday. Wayne Lewis requested the names of the teachers who called in sick during days where schools were closed and teachers were protesting in Frankfort. He did this through an email that he sent to 10 superintendents. So that was to Bath, Boyd, Bullitt, Carter, Fayette, Jefferson, Letcher, Marion, Madison, and Oldham counties.
And those are all of the counties that canceled school at any point this time, right?
Right. Also part of the request, it said, any and all affidavits or certificates of a reputable physician stating that the employee was ill or caring for an ill family member on the day or days the employee called in sick.
So that's basically saying, I want to also see the doctor's notes.
Yeah. Okay. So he also asked for the district's policies regarding sick days, for example, like when doctor's notes are required, you know, how many sick days can you take before you need to bring a doctor's note? So mm-hmm. he requested that policy information as well. I think maybe the norm is maybe that you need a doctor's note for more than 3 days. I feel like I've heard that from JCPS teachers, but I'm not stating that as fact. I'm not sure. There weren't really any days that schools were out more than 3 days in a row, except I think JCPS was out 4 days.
Really?
I believe. Wayne Lewis, in his email, cited two different statutes, KRS 156.010 and 210. And basically, these are statutes that allow the secretary to request information from school districts, and it also allows them to provide that information to the Commonwealth attorney if there's a discussion about filing a criminal complaint and things like that. So he's citing these statutes that allow him to get this information. KRS 161-155 also provides for 10 sick days, and it does not require doctor's notes every time they call in. So there's another statute for you. Lexington attorney Mark Wollander is considering filing a federal civil rights complaint against the Kentucky Department of Education. So far, he's just sent a letter saying that they're considering legal action. So this would be like a First Amendment claim, I'm assuming. You know, people have the right to peaceably assemble and the right to free speech.
Right.
So the update to this story, since this happened last Thursday, JCPS has said that they will provide the names, but no doctor's notes or affidavits. They said, since the district was closed, teachers did not use a sick day, nor did they need to provide documentation if they called off prior to the closure decision. So basically this is saying, well, they didn't use a sick day because the district was closed. This was not a contract day.
Right.
And that makes total sense, right? To me, it does.
Yeah, yeah, it does. I mean, it is kind of a workaround, but it makes sense. Yeah.
Right. So they've requested 5 more days to provide the names. I think they contract with an outside company who deals with this process. And so they're requesting more time to provide the names to Wayne Lewis. There apparently has been precedent in the past for terminating teachers for false sick days.
Yeah.
So I guess that's one thing that teachers should be aware of. Lewis says that he's requesting these names so that they can come up with a better policy for teachers to be able to protest without calling off school. But to me, like, I'm not really sure what the names would have to do with coming up with a new policy. Like,
right.
Why do you need their names if that's the goal from all of this? And I mentioned that statute that allows them to provide information to the Commonwealth attorney. And he's like, oh, we're not talking about criminal charges. We just want better policies for this in the future. Well, then why do you need this information?
Right.
The last thing I would note about this story is that Adam Edelin has made an open records request for Wayne Lewis's sick days and documentation for them. That like absolutely mirrored the language that was in Wayne Lewis's email to these school districts. And then I think Wayne Lewis said something like, go ahead, or, you know, I welcome you to do that, something like that. And Adam Edelin tweeted, no, I don't. I think you misunderstood. We already did. So that's fun.
Yeah. You know, it's something. That's for sure. You know, I do think anytime we talk about Wayne Lewis and employment, it's important to bring up that the man literally stole another man's job.
Always important to remind people.
Yeah. Stephen Pruitt was the Kentucky's education commissioner, was doing a great job, and Matt Bevin installed a whole new board, had him fired, and hired Wayne Lewis. So, you know, when it comes to, like, being integrous with your employment, Wayne Lewis doesn't really quite have a leg to stand on. All right, before we get to our conversation with Bruce, there's several quick hits I just wanted to get to, stuff that happened this week before we get into the bills that we wanted to talk about that passed the legislature last week. So first, the ACLU, they have actually already successfully sued to block implementation of SB 9. We'll talk a little bit about SB 9 in our conversation with Bruce, but it's the fetal heartbeat bill. The legislator passed it last week. The ACLU additionally filed suit asking a court to force Governor Bevin to alert them when he signed Senate Bill 5, which is a different abortion ban, in order to allow services to continue at abortion providers. Learned a lot about this in the past couple weeks. Basically, everybody comes in at 8 o'clock in the morning and they schedule everybody the day before. If the governor signs this, you know, they're going to have to cancel everybody's appointment and basically back up their whole schedule by a day, which, you know, for any business is tough, especially one that provides healthcare. Okay, Jasmine, both Adam Edelin and the Super PAC supporting him were on the air with their first advertisements of the gubernatorial campaign. To me, it feels like Edelin may have the lowest name recognition of the three candidates running. Of course, Rocky Atkins has a long history as Kentucky's Democratic leader in the House and Democratic leadership in the House. Andy Beshear has a very famous name. His father was governor. He's been the attorney general. Adam Edelin only spent, you know, one term as the auditor, probably has lower name recognition than the others. He has a TV commercial, I think at one point had renewable spelled wrong, but they fixed that. And the Super PAC, who is helping him, they put out a jingle. Have you heard the jingle, Jasmine?
I've heard the jingle.
Yeah.
Leading with Edelin.
Yeah. It's bad, but it's sure to get stuck in everyone's head, which I think is probably the goal.
It's bad on purpose, right?
I hope so.
I think so.
Yeah. If you want a governor you can truly believe in, the only choice is Adam Edelin, which I'm not sure if that rhymes, but
and
it's close
enough. Spell Edelin in the song.
Yeah.
It's very catchy.
There's some rhymes in there that are definitely some stretches. Yeah, it's something. But you know what? Definitely go check it out. It's funny. It's worth a laugh. So there you go. Okay, Judge Boasberg, the judge who originally overturned Kentucky's Medicaid waiver, he heard arguments about Kentucky and Arkansas's Medicaid waivers last week. The headline is that he remains skeptical of the program's compatibility with the central Medicaid or central mission of Medicaid, which is, of course, to provide health insurance. And, you know, work requirements do not necessarily fit with that central mission. So we'll see what happens. On April 1st, the state is going to issue updated rates for Medicaid, and it is thought that this will be when Passport really determines whether or not they're going to be able to persist. I did a long thing about Passport a couple weeks ago. That could potentially be the end of that story.
Very sad.
Absolutely. Matt Bevin said to WHAS that some legislators have asked him to veto bills which the legislator voted for, because he said, quote, they jammed so much through at the end that not all of them read the bills that they voted on, unquote. So
what?
Yeah. I think that, you know, not anybody is going to read all the bills that they vote on. That's literally impossible.
I absolutely believe that.
But when you jam all this stuff through at the end, you don't even get a passing knowledge of what you're voting on. And I think that's the real problem. You don't need to read them all, but you need to understand what you're doing. And I don't think that legislators necessarily did this because they, I mean, that's why we had to talk to Bruce, because there's so much stuff to pass
yeah,
at the end.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, and then lastly, this happened just today. Governor Bevin came out as skeptical of vaccines this week, saying that he exposed all 9 of his children to chickenpox instead of getting them the vaccine, and saying that the government shouldn't necessarily force people to get vaccines, which is absolutely nuts. You know, I try to give some quarter to Matt Bevin when we disagree on things, but this is really stupid. If you have kids, vaccinate them. That's just common sense. Just do it. It's not for you. It's for everyone else. Even if you don't necessarily agree with it, herd immunity is important, and not everybody can get vaccines. So it's very important that you get your kids and yourself vaccinated. And I'm speaking to Governor Bevin too when I say that. So
I had the chickenpox vaccine, and it was like really new when I had it.
Yeah,
never
you know,
had the chickenpox.
I'm a little bit older than you, and I was not vaccinated. I had to get chickenpox, mm-hmm. and it was not fun. You got the vaccine. You're yep. lucky. And also, that means you won't get shingles, and I probably will when I'm old. So there you go. All right, that's it for this part, and let's go ahead and hear our conversation with Bruce Maples. All right, everybody. So due to some unforeseen circumstances, we had a rough time covering the end of the legislative session this year. But our good friends and partners over at Forward Kentucky did an excellent job of tracking down how the legislature spent its final days. So today, we've invited Bruce Maples, the publisher of Forward Kentucky, back to the show to talk to us about how the session wrapped up. Bruce Maples, welcome back to my Old Kentucky podcast.
Thank you very much. I'm very excited to be here. And before we get started talking about bills, let me just say how pleased I am that My Old Kentucky podcast is part of our work, because I think y'all do great stuff, including both the podcast and the newsletter.
Well, we appreciate that. We think you do great work, too. So everybody get all of the newsletters.
That's right. Go sign up.
All right. So we have a long list of bills to get to, but I thought we would start with some of the abortion stuff, since it seems like that was the main theme from
mm-hmm.
this year.
Yes.
So I thought we would start with Senate Bill 9, which is the fetal heartbeat bill. So this passed the last day. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. It passed the last day, and just in case anybody wanted to remember what it was about, it blocks abortions as soon as a fetal heartbeat can be detected, which is usually about 6 weeks. And immediately after the bill was announced, the ACLU sued. The governor tweeted, "Bring it."
Yes, he did.
Yes. It passed the House. So on the last day, since it's a Senate bill, it passed the House, and it got 71 votes in the House, including 10 Democrats.
Yep.
I listed them here. That's Rocky Adkins, Joe Gravis, Dean Shawmore, Terry Branham Clark, Angie Hatton, Kathy Hinckley, Wilson Stone, Ashley Tackett Lafferty, and Rob Wiederstein. 10 Democrats also additionally did not vote, and those are Tom Burch, John Sims, Charlie Miller, Dennis Keene, Alvin Gentry, Susan Westrum, Rick Rand, Reggie Meeks, Jim Glenn, and Russ Meyer. So, Bruce, looking at that roster, does anything stand out to you in terms of the people who either didn't vote or voted yes for this bill?
Well, right off the bat, of course, everybody paid attention to the fact that Rocky voted for it.
Right.
Rocky Adkins running for governor. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows that he is anti-abortion, pro-life. And so he voted for it, and that didn't really surprise people. But I think what did surprise some people was the not voting people. It's like, okay, take a stand one way or the other. Mm-hmm. And it was obviously going to pass, so maybe they just thought, I'm not going to tie my name to it one way or the other.
Yeah.
I do want to point out that I think it's interesting that Julie Rocky Adams voted no.
Right.
She voted against it.
That was on the Senate side. That was right at the beginning of the session.
Right.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Right.
Yeah.
It's, you know, assuming that the courts don't lose their mind, it's going to get knocked down uh-huh. by the courts. But we all knew it was coming. And by the way, other states are passing the same bill.
Mm-hmm.
I forget if it was Tennessee or Arkansas passed it
maybe
yesterday.
Both, right. Yeah, the Julie Rocky Adams point is very interesting, because I think that the theme with the Democrats we're seeing here that voted for it are mostly rural Democrats from Eastern Kentucky. I know Joe Gravis, I think, is actually from he's from Woodford County. But other than that, you know, well, yeah, Terry Branham Clark, Rocky Adkins, Angie Hatton, Kathy Hinckley, Wilson Stone is from South Central Kentucky, but Rob Wiederstein's from Henderson. So people from outside the main urban areas, and then Julie Rocky Adams being from Louisville, you know,
right.
as a Republican who voted against it, it's starting to break down maybe more along the lines of urban-rural.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so we're starting to see that.
The next bill is SB 50, called the Abortion Reversal. So I don't think this is one that we've talked about on the podcast before, but it started out as a bill that required reporting of prescriptions for abortion-inducing drugs, like RU486. But then it had language added requiring doctors to tell patients that their drug-induced abortion can be reversed. So this passed the House with 75 votes, and 14 Democrats voted for this one. So it was all the ones that Robert mentioned above, plus Chris Harris, John Sims, Russ Meyer, and Alvin Gentry. The Democrats who didn't vote on this one were Kelly Flood, Susan Westrum, Rick Rand, Dennis Keene, Jim Glenn, and Charlie Miller. So, Bruce, were there any surprises here? And what do you think about this provision about doctors telling patients that the abortion can be reversed?
Well, first of all, the American College of Gynecologists came out with a statement when this was added to the bill, saying this is bad science. It's not
proven.
You can't tell people this because it's not proven. That's the first thing. Second thing was, you sort of, and this is my opinion, I can understand if you've got a Democrat who is anti-abortion, why they would vote for SB 9. I get that. I have no idea why anybody would vote for this bill.
And even more voted for this one.
Yeah, and even more voted for it. And it's a bad bill. It's really not, doesn't make any sense. When it started out about we want to report the number of prescriptions, well, okay, that's fine. But they added this language and you're like, what? Yeah. So I have no idea why anybody would vote for this bill.
Yeah, I mean, we saw a little bit with the next bill we're talking about. We're going to talk about here, HB 5. When it was voted on in the House, you know, it's also like a really stupid bill. The Republicans and the governor even came out and said, you know, these people said they were pro-life, but they're clearly not. So I think people are just afraid anything that involves the word abortion, voting against it means that they're going to get attacked, which they will. But they're not really willing to stand up to that, which, you know, isn't great.
Yeah.
And just a note, too, about people who don't vote. People are actually able to submit, you know, vote amendments saying they would have voted this way, and that goes into the record. And we've updated those as of, I think, 2 days ago. I think most of these people will stay as no votes, but I would be, you know, pretty surprised if SB 50 didn't see Kelly Flood's vote switch to a no. And, you know, I would be kind of surprised if Reggie Meeks on the SB 9 one didn't vote switch to a no as well. So there are probably some changes that will occur. But, you know, most of them, I think, will remain as no votes.
Right.
All right. So the last abortion bill, hopefully, that we're going to talk about this session is HB 5. It passed the House. We talked about that a little bit. But this is the bill that bans abortion based on race, sex, color, national origin, or disability. Basically, the human rights. I guess those are like the list of human rights in the Kentucky Human Rights Statute, and applying those to unborn fetuses. This actually passed the House on the last day with 32 votes, which means that four Democrats, which is half of the caucus, they actually voted for it. And the four senators that voted for it are Dennis Parrott, Johnny Ray Turner, Robin Webb, and Julian Carroll. And Gerald Neal did not vote. So, you know, anything to add on this last abortion bill?
Well, the language that the sponsor was using was just interesting to me. She was saying that anybody who voted against this bill apparently supports eugenics.
Right.
And so they support, you know, getting rid of people for their race, sex, color, or national origin.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, without riding the issue too far, there's no exception for disability in it, and which right. we've already talked about before.
Mm-hmm.
And it just seems to me to be a very cruel bill from that standpoint. The other thing is that it just seemed to me to be such a political thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, the trigger bill, I understand that. The fetal heartbeat bill, I understand that. I don't support it, but I understand it. This bill was just a political play. It was just how much ugly language can we put out there?
It's super weird to me how this would even work.
yeah, that's what I was thinking.
It just seems completely unenforceable. Like, how would you know?
And how do you know? So one of those things is color. So how would you know color?
Right.
And race is more of like can be like more subjective than some of those other things.
Right.
So I think that's just really hard to enforce. And also, how do you decide whether someone had the abortion because of one of these things?
Right. Yeah, it seems impossible.
I think if I remember, and I'd have to go back and look at the language of the bill, that the person getting the abortion actually has to sign a statement.
That seems, well, whatever.
Yeah.
There's a lot of stuff, you know, I obviously have learned a lot more about this process. There's a lot of stuff you have to sign in order to have this done. So there you go.
All right. So moving on from abortion, the next one is SB 100, which is the anti-solar bill. So we've talked about this one quite a bit, but a lot happened. So this bill drastically changes the amount utilities have to pay solar owners for electricity that they put back into the grid. Everyone assumed this bill was dead because it hadn't really moved in days. The Senate had passed it and the House had amended it. Then the Senate had refused those amendments. The House refused to budge, and then there it sat.
Right.
However, at only an hour before the midnight deadline, the House took it up, voted to remove the amendments that that made the bill less of an attack on residential solar, and they passed it. So the utility companies and their hundreds of thousands of lobbying dollars won. It passed with 55 votes. Two Democrats voted yes, Dean Shawmore and Rob Wiederstein. Five Republicans crossed over, Rob Rothenberger, Lynn Beckler, David Hale, Jim Duplessis, and Mark Hart. You know, I think the Democratic caucus was pretty upset that this bill passed. Joni Jenkins said that she felt like there were promises made to the caucus that weren't kept. Republicans said that Jim Duplessis rescinded his amendment, making it possible, but he kind of challenged that interpretation and said, I felt like we could have gotten it worked out in a conference committee, but the other side just wasn't willing to do it. So I believe he's talking about the Senate here, maybe not the Democrats. And in an interview with the Herald, Duplessis seemed motivated to making those changes to the law in a future session. So that bill saw a lot of movement there at the end. Bruce, do you have anything to add about the solar bill?
I did an editorial on the website called Dear Legislators, We Don't Trust You.
And
this is one of the examples I used, because the Democratic caucus in the House that wanted this amendment, and the amendment, it didn't solve everything, but it made the bill much better.
Yeah, more palatable, I think.
Yeah. And they were told by House leadership, we will not bring this bill forward without this amendment, which means the Senate has to agree to it, and so it's just not going to move. And then it literally at 11 o'clock at night, they bring the bill forward without the amendment, and they say that Duplessis pulled it. And everybody's like, what? And it passes. And Joni, you're right, Joni was very upset. She was like, mm-hmm. we were given promises. We were lied to, basically. And so, you know, it's a bad bill, and it was passed in a bad process with bad intent and untruths.
Right. Well, I mean, that goes to the thing about, you know, promises being made to the Democratic caucus is Republicans have no incentive or reason to keep any of their promises. They have enough power that they face no consequences if they do stuff like this. And, you know, I'm upset. And Joni Jenkins is clearly upset. And, you know, it seems stupid that they would make these promises in the first place. But, I mean, it seems like there isn't a lot of power to change it. Jim Duplessis hopefully can get something together. But it also just seems like, you know, Democrats are basically at the mercy of Republicans this session. And while the legislature is stacked up like this is kind of the big takeaway.
Well, the other thing that everybody talked about after the bill passed was apparently the lobbying dollars won.
Right. Absolutely.
I mean, the utilities rolled in there with hundreds of thousands of dollars of lobbying money working for the bill. And what, $6,000 was spent in opposition?
Something like that, yeah.
And, you know.
Yeah. I mean, there you go. That shows you how things work around here, I guess. All right, so let's move on to talk about HB 354, which is a tax cut bill. This was kind of the tax cleanup. We talked about this, the tax reforms that kind of happened at the very end of the session last year. Nobody read it. It turned out that there was a lot of stuff about nonprofits that people didn't like. They wanted to kind of remove the sales tax provision for nonprofits, mostly around like stuff at, you know, charity auctions and stuff like that. The bill actually ended up with about $105 million in tax cuts, most of which would go to banks. That was kind of released at the last second as this bill wound its way through the process. This got a lot of news that this was going to happen, but actually very few people voted against it in either chamber. So just 9 House Democrats, George Brown, Josie Raymond, Rob Wiederstein, Jeff Donahue, Reggie Meeks, Attica Scott, Lisa Wilner, Kelly Flood, and Tom Burch voted against it in the House, and only one House Republican voted against it in Kim King, and it passed without any opposition in the Senate. So, Bruce, what do you have to say about this one?
The frustrating thing, there are two frustrating things about it. One was that the initial, like you said, the initial point of the bill was to take out these taxes, sales taxes on nonprofits. And everybody, pretty much across all the aisles, was like, yeah, sure, we need to do that. Okay, that's fine. And then they started putting this bank thing in. Now, we need to explain what this is about. Banks pay a charter fee, okay, to be chartered in the state. So to operate in Kentucky, they have to pay a tax. And it's higher than the corporate income, the corporate tax.
Right.
And so they have argued for years, why are we not paying the corporate tax, you know? And what was fascinating to me was that when it came up in committee, I watched the committee hearing, and here's Democrats and Republicans both falling all over each other to say, we need to do this for our small banks in the small cities. And Jason Bailey, like an hour later, put up an article that said, there have been no small banks that have left over this tax.
Right.
And we just gave away $55 million that we really could have used. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, it's kind of interesting to me. I mean, obviously, because of the nonprofit piece and the cleanup part, that got a lot of Democrats to vote for this.
Mm-hmm.
The group of people that voted against it, you know, we've mentioned Rob Wiederstein's name a lot as somebody who's voted for a lot of these abortion bills. He even voted for the solar bill. But he actually got up on the floor and made, I think, maybe his only floor speech against this bill, which I thought was, you know, it was a good speech. And Rob's a good guy. I like him. I disagree with him on some issues. But I do think it was pretty important. I was kind of surprised more Democrats didn't actually vote against this at the end of the day, because it seemed like an easy thing to kind of like put a stamp on. You know, I don't know. It seemed a little surprising.
All right. Next is HB 114. We called this the anti-Grimes bill. It started out as a simple bill about elections. Damon Thayer's bill attacking Secretary of State Grimes failed in committee, so then he attached it to this bill as a floor amendment.
Yeah,
so
failed in committee dramatically.
Right,
failure
yeah.
was
right.
fun to watch.
Yeah, we'll talk about this in a second, but Mackenzie Cantrell had some comments that were good.
Yeah, so, you know, what this would do would strip the Secretary of State of powers regarding the Board of Elections and elections in general. Grimes says she will look at legal action to stop it. It passed completely along party lines except for Travis Brenda, who is a Republican who voted against it. And then there were also several people who didn't vote for this one as well. As Robert mentioned, Representative Mackenzie Cantrell and Senator Damon Thayer were both on Kentucky Tonight this week talking about it. And Cantrell called out his behavior, you know, about the original bill and said, I would call his behavior childish, and that would be an insult to children. So that's pretty wild.
Zing.
The State Board of Elections met on Tuesday without Secretary Grimes. Ben Chandler, who is a member of the board, said, I think we all understand that the constitutionality of this law has come into question, and it will probably have to be decided by a court at some point. But that should not, in my opinion, prevent us from carrying forward and doing the best we can under the circumstances. So, Bruce, do you have any thoughts about Senator Thayer or Mackenzie Cantrell, or about just like the legality of this bill in general?
Well, first of all, the legality I think remains to be seen. I think it will wind up in court. She will sue against it. I feel fairly certain. What's interesting is the number of candidates for Secretary of State, and not just Democrats,
right,
who have come out against the bill and
right,
said this bill's
yeah.
a bad idea.
Right.
And then a few Democrats have come out in favor of it, which I just think is fascinating. I one of the things I'm starting to get my hands around when I'm in Frankfurt is the groups and the
right.
and the players on the teams. And there is a definite split in the Republican Party in Frankfurt. And it was fascinating in that committee to watch Damon Thayer bring this thing forward, not this bill, but the original bill that he tried
right.
to get
mm-hmm.
passed. He brings it into committee, and two Republicans vote against him.
Right.
And Hoover being one of them. And so you've got Thayer carrying water probably for Governor Bevin in that regard, and Hoover shooting it down, and Thayer just losing his mind afterward. So that was fascinating to me. The other thing was the fact that once again, we have a fairly simple bill with a fairly simple purpose, and we add this entire other bill to it as
right.
an amendment, and that gets passed. And that's another case of, guess what, we don't trust you.
It's a power play. It's exactly what it is. And it was kind of interesting how it was able to be sunk by Jeff Hoover originally, but, you know, it just goes to show you that Damon Thayer has enough power to kind of get around that, and he has enough people in his pocket in the House that he's able to kind of attach this to a random other bill about elections and get it through. So,
well, the other thing is that people haven't paid attention to is that it also expanded the Board of Elections.
Right.
It added two people who are both appointed by the governor.
Uh-huh.
So the governor now has more power over the Board of Elections.
In the second, yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, and you know, Republicans may live to regret that, because you know, it's not impossible for the next election to give us a Democratic governor and a Republican secretary of state. And that's not a state we haven't existed in. That was where we were for several years with Trey Grayson and Steve Beshear. So, you know, I don't know. We'll see what happens. I think it'll end up in court, though, and I don't think it stands much of a chance there. We will see, though. All right, the last thing that we actually covered. So these are all bills that we've talked about at some point in the past. We're about to talk about bills that we haven't talked about. But the last bill that we did talk about at some point during the session is SB 6, which is the Executive Lobbying Transparency Bill. This was announced very early in the session and in the Senate. It passed very quickly, I think maybe even on that first week. But it requires the disclosure of lobbyist compensation for persons lobbying the executive branch. It's only currently required for people lobbying the legislative branch to release their information. And this would make it required for lobbying in the executive branch. It passed without opposition in either chamber. Is there anything interesting in here that we need to talk about?
Well, as we run through all these bills, I had one person, when I put the story up on our website about what had passed, I got a comment from a reader saying, I wish I'd been in a padded room when I read this story, because there's so many bad bills. But this is actually a good bill.
Right.
And it was put forward by President Stivers. Mm-hmm. And I actually saw him at an event and thanked him for it. I said, that's a necessary bill. It should have been in place a long time ago. Thank you for doing it. The lobbying stuff that goes on in the executive branch, the legislative branch, it's for passing bills. In the executive branch, it's for contracts.
Right.
It's for let's get some money.
Right.
So it needed to be there.
Certainly, maybe even more apt for corruption than the legislative process.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so the next bills we're going to talk about are bills that we maybe didn't have the chance to talk about on the podcast. So the first one is SB 7, which is a forced arbitration bill. So this would allow employers to force employees to agree to arbitration of all claims, including sexual harassment, as a condition of employment. So I don't like this bill. I think this keeps people from filing lawsuits for discrimination, sexual harassment. I'm typically against most laws that keep people from having access to justice. But this passed with 52 votes. 8 Republicans voted against it. Lynn Beckler, Danny Bentley, Derek Lewis, Robert Goforth, Jim Stewart, Tommy Turner, and again, Travis Brenda. Only one Democrat voted for the bill, and that's John Sims. So, Bruce, any thoughts about this forced arbitration?
Well, it's an interesting situation in that up until recently, every state had this law where employers can require arbitration as a condition of employment. The Kentucky Supreme Court, I believe, overturned it only in Kentucky a few years ago. And so this was supposedly to put us back in line with all the other states. And that's the argument that kept being, I mean, over and over and over. They needed a doggone, you know, doll where you pull the ring in the back and it goes, 49 states, 49 states. Because that's what they kept saying. We need to be like the other 49 states. And it was interesting because President Stivers testified in favor of it in committee and said, as a business owner, I need to be able to do this. It puts me at a competitive disadvantage with companies in other states, blah, blah, blah. Obviously, the issue is that if people have to go to arbitration, I think it was Mackenzie Cantrell, I think, who stood up and said, it was Maria Sorolis, mm-hmm. who stood up and said, we're actually putting a second system in place of arbitrators and arbitration rather than the courts. We're bypassing the courts. The other thing that was interesting was that right at the end, the AFL-CIO got them to change the bill and take out union businesses.
Interesting.
Because a lot of union contracts have arbitration clauses already in them, mm-hmm. and they didn't want this to be messing with those contracts. So they took out union shops as being affected by this.
Interesting.
And that 49 states argument, you know, I think that should go both ways because we're one of two states that doesn't have any form of felony
yes.
voter restoration. So why can't we be like the other states with that?
Right.
Right?
There you go. Jasmine, you should start a political consulting job. Bruce, you had mentioned clubs earlier. And I think that this group of people that voted against this definitely point to a different club. Like Republicans who are more apt to vote against things that may be more conservative. And mm-hmm. you know, Danny Bentley from Eastern Kentucky. There's in the same way that Eastern Kentucky Democrats are more apt to vote for abortion bills, I think you have Eastern Kentucky Republicans that are more apt to vote for labor bills, which is something I think you're seeing with some of these groups here. Travis Brenda, his name's popped up again several times as a Republican who's voted against what the Republican Party might do.
Well, there was an argument here that I didn't think got made hard enough, and if I had been, you know, on the floor, I would have stood up and made this argument. We talk about wanting to get good jobs to Kentucky. We want companies to come to Kentucky. Well, read the list of companies that have recently taken forced arbitration out of their employment contracts.
Right.
Google being the biggest one. But, you know, if we want to do that, big companies are moving away from this policy because they see that it causes morale problems. Mm-hmm. And there are people who won't go work for some place like that.
Yeah, and workers just certainly have a lot more power now than they did, you know, 10, 15 years ago because of the strength of the economy. This starts to become more of a problem, I think, if the economy ever gets worse, which it almost certainly will at some point. And I think a lot of people have started to point out real problems with the arbitration system, and Kentucky seems like it's moving in the right direction and is now halted and gone the other way. All right, so talk the next about HB 358, which is a pension relief bill. So this is a little bit complicated. So right now, universities and quasi-governmental agencies are a part of the pension system. And this bill allows those agencies to opt out of the pension system by paying their current obligations over time. This bill was passed in the Senate with a committee substitute, but then the House refused to concur with this. So it actually didn't pass yet, but it certainly points to something that might happen in the next session.
There is widespread belief that it will pass on the last day.
Okay.
That they will work out the differences and it will pass. A couple of things about it. One is that it also keeps the contribution rate for these agencies at the current level, rather than spiking, which it was supposed to do this year. It keeps it at the current level for another year. There is an op-ed, and I realize I sound like I'm, you know, promoting the website a lot.
Which, that's fine. Please promote
the
website.
Yeah, that's okay. Yeah.
There's an op-ed on the website that we put up this morning from Jason Bailey from Kentucky Center for Economic Policy. And he points out that this bill has a number of really bad provisions in it. And basically, in the name of providing relief to these agencies, they will damage the pension system.
Right.
It moves everybody to 401k style pensions. It does a number of other things. You need to go read the op-ed. The interesting thing is that if they pass it without those provisions, Governor Bevin can veto it, which means that they have no recourse because it's after the last day.
Right.
And then the spike hits
right
on these agencies and these universities. And a number of them will just go bankrupt. They'll just go out of business because they can't pay it, which is part of what happened here
in Louisville.
With seven counties.
Oh, sure.
Seven counties was dealing with this sudden pension demand. And my understanding is, I could be wrong, but my understanding is that they decided we can't deal with this. And I don't remember if they sued to get out of it or what they did, but basically, if you read Jason's thing, it's the same thing that a number of us have been saying. If you know anything about spreadsheets, you know that you change one number here and you can have a dramatic effect on a number over there. Well, what happened was the pension board was expanded by the governor, and then the pension board came in and said, we're going to lower the actuarial assumptions of return.
Right.
So rather than making 7.5% return for the next 30 years, we're going to drop it to 5.25%, 5.5%, 6%. Well, suddenly, rather than being underfunded by X amount, you're underfunded by double X amount.
Yeah.
And so suddenly all these agencies who have already been paying quite a bit of money, now they suddenly have to double what they pay. And the number is staggering. If you look at, here's an example. So let's take Murray State.
Sure. Right?
That's one of the universities in the system.
Go Racers. I think they play this week.
So. That's right. Go Racers. So the contribution to the pension would go to 89% of their payroll.
Wow.
89% of, so if you have a $2 million payroll, you've almost got another $2 million you have to pay, mm-hmm. you know, the pension system. It's just nuts.
Yeah. I think one of the bigger groups that was pointed out as really having some trouble with this was the health departments,
yes,
which are already who don't have a lot of money to spare. And right now we're dealing, of course, with a massive hepatitis A issue. Or you know, we're trying to recover from that. Getting rid of our health departments would not be great, especially in some of the counties out in the state. Yeah. So this
the other thing is that by giving this relief to the agencies, you put more burden on the people who are in the system.
Sure. Well, and we had Chris Tobey on our show, and he's been talking quite a bit about this. And one of the things that he points out is, you know, states are not allowed to declare bankruptcy. That's not that there's no bankruptcy provision for states to declare bankruptcy. But cities and quasi-governmental agencies and universities certainly can. And one of the things that he's pointed out is, you know, shifting the pension burden off of the state and onto these groups that can declare bankruptcy is a little bit like potentially looks like the state passing the buck and wanting these groups to enter into bankruptcy protection to rid these obligations from the pension system. Take that for what you will. I don't know if that's necessarily the case, but it's an interesting point that he's made there.
All right. So next is SB 67, and this is the sex with animals bill. So this would make it a crime to have sex with an animal. Kentucky did not have a law about this before, and this one passed without any opposition.
Yeah, I have no comment.
And apparently this bill has been introduced like 1,000 times, and it has never really seen any movement.
Yeah.
So
it's kind of one of those things is like, do we have a real problem in Kentucky with, you know, I don't know. So I guess we'll find out if there's any prosecutions under the statute in the future. All right, the next one's pretty interesting. It's HB 254. It's the Campus Free Speech Bill. It requires colleges and universities to affirm that they support free speech no matter what type it is. And there is some concern that it would limit counter-protesters. So we actually had a person reach out to us who is in College Democrats who said, you know, I want to talk about this. We weren't able to connect with them because of all the crazy stuff that happened to us this session. But you know, this was actually supported by both the College Democrats and the College Republican state groups, but there was some opposition in the Democratic caucus. Only two Senate Democrats voted for this bill. That'd be Dennis Parrott and Robin Webb. And only four House Democrats voted for this bill. That'd be Derek Graham, Dean Shawmore, Angie Hatton, and John Sims. Bruce, I know you had like all of these bills in a checklist in your newsletter, which everybody should subscribe to. And you had like a check for we support this and an X for we don't. And this one had like two question marks.
Yes.
Did you ever determine whether or not this one deserved a check or an X?
No, I'm waiting to see how it actually plays out in practice. It comes from, of course, the conservative mantra that they are not allowed to talk on campuses, that all campuses are liberal and therefore conservatives. And there have been some issues with conservative speakers being
booted from campus,
yeah. Run out of campus, whatever. But again, this may be a bill that sounds good on its face, but when you start putting it into practice, there could be problems.
Sure.
A number of people said, I actually think this is going to harm free speech more than support it. So we're waiting to see what the practice looks like.
But it did pass, and it won't become law. So there you go.
All right. So finally, we've got HB 46, which is the In God We Trust in Schools. This would require all public school buildings in Kentucky to have In God We Trust displayed prominently somewhere in the building. So this passed with 73 votes, including 15 Democrats, Rocky Adkins, Joe Gravis, Chris Harris, Dean Shawmore, Terry Branham Clark, Angie Hatton, John Sims, Russ Meyer, Kathy Hinkle, Wilson Stone, Cluster Howard, Ashley Tackett Lafferty, Dennis Keene, Rick Rand, and Rob Wiederstein. Two House Republicans voted against it, Jason Nemes and Chad McCoy. It passed with 29 votes in the Senate, including four Democrats, Dennis Parris, Johnny Ray Turner, Robin Webb and Julian Carroll, who have kind of been the Democrats in the Senate that have voted for some of these bills that we've talked about. Two Republicans voted against it, Chris McDaniel. Three Republicans voted against it in the Senate, Chris McDaniel, John Schickel, and Julie Rocky Adams. Any thoughts about the In God We Trust bill?
Actually, yes, I have quite a few. So first of all, let's back up a minute. In God We Trust is the national motto.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It's the official national motto of the United States.
It's on money, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It was passed, it was put into place in the mid-50s in response to the godless communist threat. And so if you think about the 50s and what the country was like in the 50s, yeah. you could sort of see why this would happen. It is always promoted that way. It's the national motto. We should have the national motto up in our buildings. If that was the end of that discussion, I wouldn't like it because it's promoting one religion or religion itself over not. And we're supposed to be, public buildings should be agnostic when it comes mm-hmm. to religion. But we know that complicated story in the United States. And so I'm not going to lose a lot of sleep over it. I think it's a bad bill. I think it's the wrong idea. But it's like, okay, sure, you know. But the problem is that's not what it is. There is, and I've got an article that I've been working on that I need to get up on the website. There is a movement of people who are doing for the religious right what ALEC has done for libertarians. Basically, they have a set of model bills, and they are walking their way through them across the states. Mm-hmm. And it's a playbook, and this is one of those bills. This is like the very first bill you're supposed to try to get passed, right? And so this is the beginning.
Yeah, they're starting simple, right?
Right, right. And they say that. And they give you talking points. These are the talking points you should use. And I looked at the playbook, and I listened to the discussion in Frankfurt, and I looked at the emails coming out from various groups supporting this. And it was the talking points from the playbook. And so you go from this to, and the free speech thing, right?
Sure.
You go from this to protection of, I have a religious right to refuse you service, right? That's going to be down the road. It keeps going. So this is the beginning of that process. And it worries me because if there was ever a state where people could go with this, this would be one of those states.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly. Yeah.
And actually talked to Jason Nemus about this bill, so I was very glad to see that he voted against it.
Yeah.
But, you know, bills like this raise some establishment clause
oh, yeah.
issues, so there, you know, maybe there's a lawsuit coming with this one. I don't know.
We'll see. Yeah, we're hearing from ordained Baptist minister Bruce Maples now.
So. Well, exactly, and one of the things that frustrates me is that Baptists, of all people, should know about separation of church and state.
Right.
And for them to stand up and vote for this is just shows that they don't know their history or their heritage.
Yeah. So that was the end of the week, last week, that happened in the session. And Bruce, thank you so much for going over all these bills with us. There are lots of actions, though, that were not taken. You know, charter school funding, scholarship tax credits, medical marijuana, felon voting rights, on and on and on. Is there anything on your list of bills of actions not taken that you think might pop up on the last day?
Oh, yeah.
What do you think?
I think there is a strong movement in the legislature to get the tobacco-free schools bill across the finish line.
Okay.
That's one that you hear everybody on both sides say, yes, we need to finish that. I think it has a good shot.
And that one's a little complicated because of with the vaping part.
They added the vaping part.
Right.
Right. And they also added the opt-out clause for school boards.
Right.
And I think they, and don't hold me to this, I think they added the amendment that said that it didn't apply off campus if students weren't present.
Okay.
So adults who smoke, I think that's okay.
Oh, yeah, football games and stuff like that.
Yeah, okay. I think so. Another one that has a shot because it's passed everything it needs to pass, it needs one more vote, and that's the workplace pregnancy accommodations bill. That has a possibility. I checked with Joni Jenkins yesterday to make sure I was right about that, and she said, yes, it's had all its readings. It needs one more reading and a vote, and it could pass. So those are two. You've got the pension relief bill that is almost surely going to pass mm-hmm. in some form. There was one, I don't remember, there was one other. If you go to the website, I've got an article up about five bills that could still pass.
Okay.
And so they're listed there.
So go to the website. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
And of course, the problem is, have you ever heard of the term mule bill?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just add everything to the top of it, like let it carry.
Right. So a mule bill is basically a bill with nothing in it except a number, and they can put stuff in it at the last minute. There is some thought that there's a couple of those things that could get passed at the last minute. The most shocking would be if the pension bill, there is a pension bill. And there's actually two, if I remember correctly. If one of those suddenly pops up on the last day and gets ramrodded through, that would be pretty upsetting to a lot of people.
Sure.
But I'm pulling for the tobacco-free schools bill. I really would like to see that pass. There's a lot of emotion around passing it. People. What was interesting was I watched Heath. Richard
Heath, yeah.
Yeah. He was against it.
Really?
And stood up on the floor and said, now that we have these amendments, I'm changing my vote. And he voted for it. And that made a difference, I think. Other people were like, oh, wow, okay.
Okay.
So I think it's got a shot.
All right. Yeah, it sounds like the stuff that you mentioned there on the last day might not be so terrible. Usually it's the worst stuff that passes on the last day. But, you know,
right.
Tobacco-free bill or tobacco-free schools and pregnancy accommodations don't sound so bad. So,
yeah, let's just wait and see.
Yeah, let's wait. Absolutely. Absolutely. If you're in JCPS, make sure your kids are taken care of on that day. I'm pretty sure school will be canceled. So, all right, Bruce, thank you so much for joining us for this conversation. How can people get in touch with you?
They can go to the website. There's a contact form. Contact us right on the website, forwardky.com. They can sign up for newsletters. We have a general newsletter and four specialized newsletters, of which one is My Old Kentucky Podcast Newsletter, which is one of the best newsletters in the country.
Oh, wow.
So you need, if you don't read anything else, you need to go sign up for that.
All right. Well, thank you so much. And Bruce, thank you very much for joining us today.
And Jasmine, how can people get in touch with us?
They can find us on Twitter and Instagram at My Old KY Pod. They can like our Facebook page. You can listen to our podcast on the podcast app of your choice and also Spotify. We have a weekly newsletter that comes out that you can subscribe to, as well as Forward Kentucky's other newsletters at forwardky.com/email. Bruce Maple says it's very good. So
best in the country.
Take his advice, I guess. And finally, we have a Patreon where you can support what we do every week, and you can donate to that at patreon.com/myoldkentuckypodcast, and we will send you a sticker.
Thank you very much, everybody. We will see you next week.